This is the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. This week we are just on the audio whilst Tip TV move TV studios. We will be back in the flesh, so to speak, next week, but today we're just on the audio. I spoke to Robert Hayward this week, who is a Conservative peer and former Conservative MP. He served as the MP for Kingswood between 1983 and 1992 and was made a life peer by David Cameron in 2015. Now, many will know Robert in Westminster as an expert on sophology, meaning elections and polls, of course. I first met Robert during my time at Comrades, where I helped him to prepare a briefing for the media on the 2013 local elections. He does these briefings quite regularly when there are local elections to help everyone understand what might be going on and, you know, what to look out for and that sort of thing. So I thought he was a really useful person, really a great expert to speak to try and unpick some of the results from this week's elections. And we sat down at his home in London this week to discuss the results from Thursday's elections and what they might mean. And here is that conversation. So, Robert Lord Hayward, thank you for joining me. Lots to get through, of course, and I want to go through each of the different sort of sets of election results in turn. But before we do that and go on to the local election results, I mean, what stood out for you as we sit here on Saturday lunchtime?
I think there are probably two results that I regard as of long-term significance and two individuals. One is Sadiq Khan's victory in London, which is his victory, major achievement in terms of his role, where he came from in society, and Ruth Davidson in Scotland and her role and where she came from in society. And I think they will play major roles over the next few years in their particular parties.
Mm. I mean, when we try and make sense of the results, I guess obviously our politics is so diverse now with all the nations and the regions, and it's quite hard to cut through the noise and understand really what's going on. I mean, let's take it in turn. If we look at the local election results, we keep hearing about this projected national vote share. And, you know, there's a lot of differing views as to what that actually means. Some people compare, so I've got it here, so Labour 31, Conservative 30, Lib Dems 15, UKIP 12. And there seems to be, if that ends up being what it is, two interpretations of that. One is to compare it to the general election, which would show Labour gaining and the Conservatives falling back. One would be to compare it to 4 years ago, which is much more negative for the Labour Party. What do you think about this? How useful is this projected national vote share in your view? And which of those interpretations do you think is more valid? I mean, is this just a subject of opinion?
I think it's interesting for the day after the election. If we have a European referendum in 6 weeks' time, when we have a European referendum in 6 weeks' time, will UKIP be relevant thereafter? So therefore, trying to compare an election that took place while the referendum campaign is going on is immediately called into question if you're going to look at it versus 2017 or 2020 or wherever you may choose. So interesting, but I don't think it sends much of a message other than looking at the minute detail of some of the results.
But I suppose for Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, as we saw with Oldham last year, it does feel like almost expectations are so low that he sort of surpasses them and ends up in a stronger position, if you like, within his own leadership.
I think that's certainly true. Looking at the elections, particularly in England, the expectation was that the Labour Party would lose 100, 150 seats. They've lost somewhere around 30 to 40, probably.
Mm. And we're still getting results.
Results, so we're not absolutely clear. But let's assume it's around that figure. So he's done better than was expected. But against any analysis over the last 30 or 40 years, he's done badly. So you can pick the figure, you can pick the result, you can pick the percentage that suits your particular argument. I think the message from the election, not only in England, but also across the whole of the United Kingdom, is that they are enormously varied and send different messages in different ways.
I want to come on to the nations, but before we do, I mean, one of the things that people try and do with local election results is look at specific areas and try and extrapolate from that what that might mean for the, you know, the direction of travel in marginal seats or wherever it might be. We were talking off air that you were saying how remarkable it was that that's quite difficult to do. I mean, could you explain that a bit more?
One of the striking things is how inconsistent the results are. They're almost consistently inconsistent. If I take two sets of results from different parts of the country, which will illustrate my initial thoughts, Pendle and Rossendale, both in the north of England, very close to each other, demographically very similar, Tory marginal seats. And yet they went in opposite directions. Pendle went to the Tories, Rossendale went to the Labour Party. South of England on the Sussex coast, Ada and Worthing, demographically miles from Pendle and Rossendale. And in one, the Lib Dems gained against the Conservatives. In the other, the Conservatives gained. So apparently contradictory results in authorities right next door to each other. So wonderfully inconsistent right across the United Kingdom, but particularly in the London, in the local elections.
And obviously, as a Conservative peer, I mean, how do you think the government would look at this set of results? You know, typically, this is the time when the governing party gets a bit of a kicking. Presumably, they'll be reasonably satisfied, but at the same time, you know, 4 years ago was a bad set of results, and there wasn't a lot of progress made.
I think their first reaction will be one of disappointment, because the expectation was that the Labour Party was going to get a real kicking. There were going to be lots of authorities that were going to fall to the Conservatives, which haven't fallen. So I think there will be disappointment in the first 24, 48 hours. Thereafter, I think there'll be a realisation that governments always get kicked. There was a whole series of problems during the recess. There then been problems with the NHS strike and arguments about academies. So it hasn't been a good period for the government. And yet, despite that, the government hasn't had a kicking. And I think if one looks at it in a week or a month or 2 months' time, with the perspective of detailed analysis, I think the government will probably be happier than the Labour Party will be.
I suppose there's going to be the EU referendum, so in many respects that's going to trump everything. I mean, let's go on to the nations, because as I mentioned, you know, it is so diverse. And let's start with Wales. I mean, I suppose, you know, Labour have 29 out of the 30 available seats. Not a lot of change in Wales by the looks of things. Plaid in second, Conservatives in third, so they've kind of switched places. But UKIP gaining 7 seats from 0 feels like the story. I mean, what's your interpretation of the results in Wales?
I think the Labour Party would be pleased in two ways. One, because they didn't lose as many seats as they feared they would. And secondly, because the opposition they're up against in the Assembly is split in so many different ways. They can govern with a high degree of comfort over the next few years, knowing that it's unlikely that Plaid and UKIP are going to vote too often together. If any Labour administration in Wales can drive those together, it'll indicate that they've got serious problems. On UKIP, that's their good results, and it's surprising in many ways. What appears to have happened is that the traditional Labour, working class, mining areas, industrial areas of the northeast of Wales and of the valleys have decided they couldn't vote for Conservatives. There is a social issue with Plaid because of linguistics, and therefore the alternative to kick the Labour Party is to go to UKIP. And those are the areas in which UKIP appear to have done particularly well, aggrieved Labour voters. So while the news appears top line to be good for Labour, they've got a problem that their industrial vote is not as secure as it might at first seem.
But it's interesting, that fractured nature of Welsh politics, isn't it? Because it doesn't seem like much chance of Labour having a sort of SNP-style surge for Plaid, does it, because of the nature of that nationalism?
Absolutely. I've lived in Wales for a number of years, and Plaid have always had this difficulty that the sense of those who are monolingual will not support Plaid except in really quite exceptional circumstances. And all credit to them for their victory in the Ronza, which is monolingual labour industrial. But yes, that is a barrier. Now, it's a barrier which in Scotland the SNP overcame in the end, because the SNP was originally a Protestant East Coast party, and they managed ultimately, after 30 years of trying, to get into the great Labour Catholic areas. No argument that Plaid couldn't do the same over a period of time. So beware, but at the moment it looks as if the two different groups have gone off, one towards Plaid and one towards UKIP.
I mean, let's talk about Scotland. I mean, you know, I think it's fair to say when we look at Wales and Scotland, Scotland's been the story in the last couple of years for obvious reasons, and with the referendum and what happened in May. I mean, I think there's kind of two stories here. One is that the SNP obviously lost their majority, which raises a question about the the potential for a second independence referendum. And then the second story, as you mentioned earlier, is Ruth Davidson. I mean, let's start on the SNP first. I mean, how satisfied or dissatisfied would they be? Because on the face value, they don't have a majority anymore, so it's hard for them to call a referendum. But there's benefits to not having a majority too, do you think?
I think they'll be pretty pleased. They'll be disappointed in the first instance that they didn't get an overall majority, so they've got to depend on others to govern. But I don't think they face a major problem. They're just short of a majority. They can depend on the Greens, for example, in terms of votes. And the Labour Party will be desperate not to ally themselves with the Conservatives under any circumstances, because they've got to come back from the dead. And you can't ally yourself with the party that appears to be growing so rapidly if you want to come back from the dead and say, we're here, we're genuinely an alternative to the SNP in the Glasgows and the old industrial belts of central Scotland. So they've got the real problem. The SNP, I think, pretty happy, but just slightly disappointed in the first instance that they haven't got that overall majority, which they would have wanted.
I mean, we'll come to the Conservatives in a minute, but because that is obviously a huge story. But on this referendum question, now, the SNP don't have a majority. I'm looking at the numbers here. They've got 63 seats. 65 would be a majority. The Greens have six. So in theory, you know, Greens plus SNP calling for a referendum could potentially be, you know, beneficial to that cause. If Britain was to vote for Brexit in a month or so's time, I mean, presumably that would be the SNP's raison d'etre to bring this up again. I mean, do you think that would be something that they could deliver, another referendum, given that they don't have a majority? Is unrealistic.
If there were Brexit, yes, they could deliver it. No, assuming Scotland was part of the Remain vote, but we are talking about massive constitutional issues, not just for Scotland, but for Northern Ireland as well, where I expect, outside Gibraltar, to be the largest Remain vote. So if England votes to leave, I think there'll be problems not only for Scotland but for Northern Ireland, a matter for another time, no less. But certainly in the short term, Nicola Sturgeon hasn't got the mandate to go for a second referendum. Oil is making the possibility of independence more difficult. So unless there is an English exit and a Scottish Remain, then I don't see a referendum in the near future. That is one part of politics where the ground really did move against the SNP on Thursday.
Now let's come to Ruth Davidson and the Conservatives. Obviously a spectacular result, plus 16 seats, replacing Labour as the official opposition in Scotland. I mean, how has this come about? Because before the election, there was a lot of people talking about the prospect of Labour coming third, but it always felt like it was couched in the sort of tone that they probably wouldn't. And yet here they are, and they have. I mean, how much of this is down to simply Ruth Davidson's leadership?
I was one of the people who thought that the Tories wouldn't quite make it. I failed. I think it's a phenomenal performance. And whereas there is one or two questions against Nicola Sturgeon, the impact for a referendum, she doesn't have a majority, I think Ruth Davidson comes out, and what questions are there to ask other than where does her political future go? It's a stunning performance, and I can't recall any politician in Britain doing likewise so quickly off the back of one election in what is, after all said and done, one part of the United Kingdom. It is, when you say that the Conservatives got 16 extra seats, one has to remember that that's actually more than twice what they had beforehand. She has almost single-handedly brought the Tories back from the complete dead. And I think talk about what she might do in the future is stupid and irrelevant at this stage. I think one just should reflect on a truly phenomenal performance on her part. And what was significant was that David Cameron didn't go there during the election campaign, and he didn't go there yesterday. He stayed in England. This is purely Ruth Davidson's victory. And if one looks at the Conservative and Unionist Party's descriptor, it was Ruth Davidson for effective opposition rather than some other broad message. It was highly personalised, and it worked to a degree that I think virtually nobody had expected. She won Edinburgh Central, Conservatives won Aberdeen West. On nobody's list of checks, what might happen. So phenomenal performance by the Tories, and that is, in simple terms, by Ruth Davidson.
I mean, a lot of mischief makers then look at that result and say, oh, she's a future Tory leader. Presumably that's quite difficult, though, isn't it? Because, I mean, where is she going to be an MP for in the first place to get there? But it's a compliment, isn't it, I guess?
It's an enormous compliment. And, of course, the one thing that one's certain about is that the people who are talked about as future Tory leaders never make it. it's a fair political maxim. So that's the end of her future, one might say. But it's not relevant. She's got her feet very clearly on the ground. Mm. She wants to forward the Tory party and therefore herself in Scotland. She's got to prove herself as an effective leader of the opposition. Mm. It's not an easy task. And one can think of many people who failed as leaders of the opposition and been surpassed by others.
And presumably, do you think there's room to grow further? I mean, obviously, there's not going to be a lot of a Scottish Assembly election, Scottish Parliament election, sorry, for 4 years. But, you know, is there scope? Is this the ceiling now for the Tories there? Or do you think that they can go higher? Presumably, you were going to say they can go higher. But you know, is that reasonable?
I've got my analyst's hat on rather than my pro-Tory hat on. There are local elections next year. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Ruth Davidson's future is not measured in years. She will be measured in 12 months' time by, do the Tory party deliver in local election terms? And if the Tories don't make the advances in 12 months, she'll be blamed for it. If they do, then she will be considered as the truly advancing politician, probably of any political party, but certainly of the Tories and certainly in Scotland. So her time horizons are somewhat different from some other people who might be looking to Cameron's resignation after 2018 or whenever.
I mean, if we come back to Labour, if some of the other results were ambiguous, were certainly negative in Scotland, but if the English locals were ambiguous, one area of absolute success was London, Sadiq Khan, the new London mayor. I mean, what's your interpretation of that campaign and some of the results that are coming through? I mean, I know you've only had a chance to briefly look at some of them, but what are you noticing?
I think, as I said at the start, all credit to Sadiq Khan for winning. It is not stellar. If you look at the general election last year, the Labour Party won London by 8% in a year when the Tories were winning across the whole of the United Kingdom. So to win London is actually not that great an achievement for Labour. Mm. It was an achievement by Boris to win it for the Tories. But he has got a great opportunity and he's got a clear run for a number of years. What is striking is that there does not appear to have been a surge in turnout in Labour voting areas. If anything, some of the most conservative voting areas produced bigger increases against 2012. And what's also striking is that some of the areas of London actually swung to the Conservatives. Mm. And they weren't necessarily the areas that would be regarded as anti-Labour or anti-Muslim. Some of the areas that include quite large Muslim populations didn't turn out in much greater numbers and certainly didn't swing to the Labour Party, as has been suggested.
And we're starting to see some briefing and, you know, coming out of this defeat for the Conservatives. I mean, it was obviously, I think it's fair to say, a quite tough campaign, quite aggressive campaign. I think Tim Shipman was, you know, starting to talk about that Zach Goldsmith was being blamed as an inadequate campaign, and that's why the campaign was so aggressive. I mean, is that fair to Zach? I mean, or is London just par is a Labour victory in London, and Boris, as you say, was special?
I think it's a bit unfair to Zach. Before the election, everybody was saying that both Sadiq and Zach had not turned the electorate on, and yet we had this massive increase in turnout. They're both very different personalities from the people that preceded them. Ken on one side and Boris on the other were huge personalities, their own people. And I think it's unfair to Zach because he is a certain sort of person. And as I say, Sadiq is fairly quiet, softly spoken as an individual. In a city, we're not like New York, but you certainly have to shout pretty loud to get your message across to a multicultural, massive city like this.
Mm. And presumably, Sadiq Khan, I wrote a piece for The Eye a couple of days ago suggesting that Sadiq Khan now becomes Labour's almost most important politician. He's the most senior elected politician and as that independent voice in London. I mean, presumably he becomes really important now for the Labour Party as that governing presence.
I think he becomes fairly important. I wouldn't overstate it. There's all this, well, he's got the third largest personal mandate in the whole of Europe. Yes, that's fine. But he's got to administer a city, and any major city in the world is difficult in this day and age to administer. It's difficult to make a mark in a major city unless you start off as a massive personality. If he can cut his way through and be seen as an effective, good managing mayor of a major city, then he has good prospects for the future. But it's not easy to run a place like London.
We'll see if he delivers, I suppose. I mean, I guess in closing, it'd be worth talking a little bit about the EU referendum, just because, you know, that is obviously coming up. I think that in a week's time, this will all not be forgotten, but it will become the past and everyone will be looking forward to the referendum. I mean, what's your sort of assessment of the state of the referendum campaign at the moment? A lot of people still think that Remain will eventually prevail. I mean, would you share that view, or do you think it's too close to call?
I think it's a London-centric view that says, oh, well, it's clear Remain will get through in the end. I think I've been out into 8-9 constituencies outside London during April. And I'm not here talking about Tory party workers. I'm talking about people on the doorstep. And I'm left with a series of impressions. One, that there is a bigger well of leave than most polls pick up. But that most people haven't started thinking about it yet. It is fairly clear that most people are, at the moment, are, other than those who are utterly committed to one side or the other, and that's particularly on the Leave side, it's a very large number of people, I shouldn't use the word most, who are swung by the last piece of information that they've been confronted with, either on the Leave side or on the Remain side. I think what we will see from early June is people will be saying, oh, I'm sick to death with it, but they will also be concentrating on it at the same time. I'm hopeful that we will be surprised by the turnout because it's such an important issue. I think there will be 60% turnout. I hope there will be at least. And I also hope there'll be a clear verdict. The last thing this country will need.
So 51-49 or something.
Anything under kind of 46-54 will actually cause problems because it'll cause bitterness on one side or the other and could have constitutional effects because different parts of the UK are voting in different ways. So I think we will start getting the hype and the attention onto the referendum outside of London and outside the national media from now on. But people will really turn their minds to it, I think, in early June.
Robert Lord Hayward, thank you very much.
Thank you.